Hey folks, before we get to this week's episode of Positively Trek, I'd like to take a moment to give a special thanks and shout out to some of our Patreon supporters. It is you who makes it possible for us to bring you this show each week. So, thank you so much to Carl Morris, Joyce Marin, Jim Stoffel, Dave Garcia, Rick Young, and Paul D. Kinnear. To become a Patreon supporter of Positively Trek, simply go to patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can join at any level, which will give you early access to some episodes and access to other features, including associate producer credits and shoutouts. Thank you so much to those of you who have already pledged to help out the show, and to everyone else, thank you so much for listening. And now, let's get on with the show.
To lunch room, Mr. Spock. Here. Look what I brought you.
This is my friend, Detan. He's very curious about Vulcan.
Hello, Detan.
Where did you get this?
This is very old.
Well, they read to us from it at the meetings. It tells the story of the Vulcan separation.
So, Dan, I'm really excited about today's episode because we're going to talk to Una McCormick. And I haven't talked to her since last episode. It's just been too long.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so I got up this morning to record these episodes, and I honestly thought, like, oh, I'm really looking forward to the conversation with Una McCormick. That'll be great. This first episode, yeah, I came up with some idea to talk about Star Trek pets. It'll be a fun discussion, I guess. And then we have the most amazing episode, Noah Averback Katz, and Una McCormick joins us as well for that one. That was incredible. So this day has been amazing already. Yeah. And we're still not to what I thought was going to be my favorite part.
Oh, it just goes downhill now. Yeah, it'd be rubbish no. now. Just to you're like, oh, that was nearly a perfect birthday.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm so excited.
Well, yeah, and even Noah said that he has read the autobiography of Mr. Spock, which we're going to talk about on today's show. Yeah, so,
yeah. So it's
people are reading it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think most people are liking it. I think if you don't like Discovery, you're not going to like it. And there's not much I can do about that. So, you know, there you go. But, you know, people don't have to like Disco. They, you know, they just, since they don't leave a review on Amazon. That's the main thing.
So this tells me that you have probably read some reviews of people who don't watch Discovery that, I don't know, maybe they were a little disappointed, but I was surprisingly very happy to see how much of Discovery, and even not even that, but Picard, mm-hmm. that you worked into this. So what were the challenges of that while there's this ongoing series coming out as you're writing?
Crikey. Well, okay, so obviously we've got original series, we've got the movies, we've got the reboot movies, we've got the animated series, because my goodness, we get that young Spock episode in. Yeah. Then we've got Disco. Then we connect it up to Picard. And then we do our best not to do anything that will spoil, that will disagree with Strange New Worlds. So, I mean, I'm losing fingers now, I'm running out of fingers. So we had all of these kind of different things that we wanted to nod to or make consistent, or feel like we had brought in or covered in some way. And I will be the first to say that it was bloody complicated. It was not the easiest task I've set myself. But, you know, I cut my teeth on Tolkien fan fiction. So, you know, drawing large, long timelines, it kind of comes in the nature. And when you've read Lord of the Rings and kind of, you know, you've read Tolkien's timelines at the back where he's going through what's happening on every day in March 3019, you kind of think, okay, well, that's the sort of meticulous detail I need to bring to it. And then if all else failed, I had Dayton Ward and John Van Sitters to say, aha, you have forgotten this tiny but absolutely crucial fact. And can we fix that, please? So we worked really, really, it was really quite tricky. I think particularly with the Disco stuff, we were starting to, you know, it was making things quite tight. Yeah, you were kind of going, oh, do the ages quite fit? And I think we did get them to work. I think there's sufficient leeway in kind of dates of birth and that kind of thing that we did get things to work. So fingers crossed, there's not any kind of blaring errors in it. Yeah.
No, I thought it worked very well. I was very impressed. I was just like, wow, I can't believe how much you've worked in here. Yeah. And, you know, even to the point that if someone hasn't watched Discovery, but they're a big fan of Spock's, I don't think they're going to get lost because we're just learning more about Spock's background that you don't need to know everything about Spock to appreciate this book.
I hope
that's
so.
That's the point of an autobiography.
Yeah, and we sort of, you know, we dip into bits of beta canon here and there. I think there are nods to sort of Diane Duane novels and Barbara Hambly novels and so on. But obviously not taking them as something, you know, it's what's on screen that we sort of take as fixed. So hopefully there's lots of little Easter eggs. But yeah, I mean, if you don't know Disco, you could hopefully read those chapters and they would just feel like a compelling narrative. You know, we meet his Amanda's parents and that side of the family, which are pretty much my invention. And hopefully they feel kind of as real. Or the people he's, you know, makes friends with at the academy, that kind of thing, at Starfleet Academy. They hopefully will feel as real. So if you don't know Disco, I think hopefully the book is still worth reading.
Yeah, so I'm glad you said they feel real. And I'm just going to mention to our listeners that we are getting into spoilers. So we're just going to assume you've read the book or you want to be spoiled. But I wanted to point out that I thought they did feel very real. And I wondered if you pulled a lot from the experiences you had with your grandparents or schoolmates or whatever, if there were some stories that you brought into your life into this.
Oh, I basically didn't have any grandparents. Three of my grandparents had died long before I was born. And then my surviving grandfather died when I was about eight. So I didn't have any grandparents. There was a great aunt who figured. I think I've observed other people's grandparents and thought, oh, what a marvelous idea that is to have in your life. You know, that'd be wonderful. It's just a function of how my family went. My father was very old when he got married. So he was nearly 60 when I was born. And my mother was in her 40s when I was born. So, you know, I just had elderly parents. They just didn't weren't alive. So I've sort of observed other people. And I thought, oh, God, that would be marvelous, wouldn't it? Particularly once I had a little girl. We had a kid and I was watching my friends kind of with small kids hand the kid over. So, God, grandparents would be a really wonderful idea at this point. So I thought it'd be lovely to give him this sort of unexpected gift of these two really, really sorted and quite laid back, but also very intellectual, not sloppy intellectually, but laid back and kind of generous intellectually. And give him those as a sort of touchstone on Earth, because I felt he kind of deserved it. They're low pressure, yeah. They're not boring,
yeah.
But they're interesting in the right ways, yeah?
Yeah, I really loved those characters, like the deep philosophical conversations they have into the evenings and stuff. I could totally picture them. And then just the small revelation that the whole fascinating thing comes from his cousin. I thought that was brilliant. That was his human cousin, I should say.
Yeah, I thought that would be fun to sort of, you know, subvert expectation that maybe you know, because it's so associated with the eyebrow going up and you think that must be a Vulcan thing. No. It's his Sherlock Holmes style cousin who's just intensely interested in everything. Fascinating, yeah. And he kind of picks it up from him. They both sort of adore him, don't they, and kind of follow him around, and he's up for it, you know, because, you know, it's like, of course you're interested, it's very interesting. So I had a lot of fun with that. I thought it'd be fun to subvert that and make it a inherited from his human side.
It's funny because it does slot in really nicely with, and you mentioned recently that you're doing a rewatch of Enterprise, and I remember that was one of the big criticisms of Enterprise, is that the Vulcans that we see in the first few seasons, they're not interested in exploration. They're not, they're very much insular and isolationist and that kind of thing. So, you know, that's not the Spock we know, who finds everything fascinating. Well, yeah, that comes from his unique heritage. I love that.
And there's a really good thing in a Diane, I think it's in a Diane Duane novel that I think she suggests that, and this is before Enterprise, I'm sure. I'd have to check the dates. She sort of runs with this idea that most Vulcans just don't leave Vulcan. Yeah. Why would I want to leave Vulcan? Vulcan's obviously awesome and, you know, the best place there is. But of those that go, they travel widely. They become intensely cosmopolitan, extremely well-traveled, extremely knowledgeable. And I found that a really convincing sort of vision of what their society would be like, that most Vulcans don't leave, you know, and they're happy there. It's, you know, it's stable, it's steady, it's consistent. People aren't sort of bursting into tears every 5 minutes. But of the ones that leave, it's a particular kind of curiosity that gets, and they don't lose the bug, yeah? They keep sort of being outward facing. So I had that at the back of my mind as well. I found that very persuasive, I think.
Well, you know, 55 years of Spock, it's like you bring so much more to this. And Dan, what were you going to say? Because I just found it really interesting that we can learn some more about Spock. Even though we've read so many books, there's still more to dig in there, you know?
Mm-hmm. And especially the fact that it's, you know, ostensibly a firsthand account, right? It's from the man himself. And the format of this in, you know, it's different from the other three autobiographies we've gotten from Titan Books. This one is basically the manuscript that Spock dictates to Jean-Luc Picard for him to kind of decide how it should be published or what should be done with it. What made you decide to kind of go that route and make it that kind of more personal memoir addressed to a particular person?
Is it pronounced Tassan a lot?
Tassan a lot, I think I would say. Okay. But my Vulcan accent is very poor. So, I think we wanted to, I can't quite remember where the idea came from. I think it was it was fairly honest sort of talking about the book. We're, you know, we're kind of, I think people like Dayton and John Weathersitters and Kat Camacho, who's the editor at Titan, we kind of, you know, got together an email and sort of, okay, where in his life is this going to be? And then, you know, we kind of made that decision. And then I think we all felt that it needed a specific audience. And I think partly that's, if you kind of compare it to the Janeway book, that felt to me, I've said this in other places, but that felt to me like a very public statement, yeah? It's not like she's setting the record straight, but it's like she's sort of writing a memoir for a public audience, yeah? People who had heard about Voyager and want to hear the truth. Whereas this seemed to me a more intimate and private memoir. But Spock is thinking, but I am a public figure, and there are certain things I need to get down, and I need to pass these on to someone that I trust intensely to know what's the right thing to do. And that person, we all agreed, would be Picard. That just seemed the obvious choice. So I think it suited the individuals, the characters concerned, that Janeway would be mindful of her public and would want to sort of put an account before them and be in charge of that account, not to tell lies, but to make sure that everything was clear, yeah? Whereas Spock, I think, would be a little bit more, not discreet, but it's a little bit more introverted, for want of a better word, I think. He would want to set an account down, addressed to a specific person, and then let that person judge, I think, where it was what would be the best thing to do to present it in public. So I imagined it as a written manuscript, probably handwritten, actually. But perhaps he did sort of record bits of it. I didn't imagine it spoken. And then Jean-Luc gets a Picard gets. I imagined him as sort of literary executor of Spock's estate. So the book also talks about other papers that he's preparing for publication. I think there's like essays on Surak and you know, translations of Conan Doyle and Romulan poetry and that kind of thing. So there's a big stack of things that he's working through. And I think he's got Sarek's Sanalat as well. He's got Sarek's poetry, hasn't he? So there's lots of other stuff he's doing. Sorry, my throat's just, I'm just going to grab some water. So I'll stop rambling now.
No worries. No, I did notice a lot of, of course, your background is in sociology, and a lot of, I'm assuming, research methods and that sort of thing entwined with that part of your career and stuff. And I did notice a lot of like the kind of that sort of research coming into this with the descriptions of the manuscripts and all this kind of stuff. And I thought that was really kind of fun. And it really builds out that world of like, yeah, these are characters that we see in TV shows and movies, but it feels like a real life. And they would have left this trove of things that a real researcher would have to sift through and kind of assemble and figure out. And I love that kind of real world connection there.
Yeah, so I'm glad that works. So just up the road from here at, in Cambridge, we've got the, well, you imagine the kind of archives we've got here, but we've got, you know, Winston Churchill's papers. And that, and like, can you imagine what that kind of archive would be like? And I imagine that Spock's archive would be similar. This is, you know, almost 200 years of being a public figure as a first a Starfleet captain, and then, you know, as a diplomat involved in major negotiations, you know, putting major treaties together. There would be a huge, vast wealth of correspondence and papers written for internal discussion, and, you know, letters to friends about trying to think things through. And then, you know, his chess club notes and this sort of thing. Yeah, there'd just be tons and tons of stuff. And there's a little bit of it. I'm really, like I said, I'm a big fan of Tolkien. So a little bit of, you know, thinking of Christopher Tolkien plowing through his father's his father's manuscripts and that kind of thing. So yeah, I think it's, I've not done much archival work, but the stuff I've done is fascinating, in fact. So I like
I'm feeling it. That word's going to come up a lot.
Yeah, the eyebrows. I like to think of Picard doing that. I think he'd enjoy it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's also illustrations in the book. I wasn't expecting to see that. Are we to assume that these are pictures and illustrations that were sent to Jean-Luc too, I guess?
These are part of the archive, yeah. These will be part of the literary archive, yeah. There's illustrations in the Janeway book as well. I think there are illustrations in all of the autobiographies. Russell Walks has done the ones for my two books, and we've had myself, Russell, and Kat Camacho, just these emails going, which bit should we put in? And what, you know, and partly you're thinking, what do we really like? But what would people really love to see and really enjoy seeing? And I think they're just, I know sometimes, often I'm partway through the book and some of the images arrive and it can just put a spin on something that I'm telling, because I don't have much kind of visual imagination. So to suddenly get these images is hugely helpful for me. Little chubby faced baby Spot is adorable in one of them. Absolutely gorgeous. And careful. If you look at them carefully, there's a beautiful one of the sort of objects on his desk, and you've got his mother's sort of pendant, and then there's a picture of his lovely pet in the background.
Oh, that's great!
Just lovely stuff that we really hope people sort of, you know, just look a bit closer and you'll see these. It'll be worth it. Yeah. So we all love it. We're all thinking really hard about what people will like and enjoy and, you know, get from it.
Well, the one thing I really do like is expanding on his family. We've seen so much in Star Trek and even books about Spock and his parents and that relationship. But, you know, a lot of authors and kind of stay away from Cybok, you know, from Star Trek V. And Michael's kind of a new early entry in the last few years. And, you know, we were talking about the grandparents, and you start to realize he has an expanded family like most of us do. And we don't always acknowledge the fact that he can be influenced by so many different family members besides his parents. And so I really love how you worked in Cybok, and then he's got his human sister and his stepbrother who's got emotions, and he has to find his place in the in-between of that. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, that's the central thing. No, I wasn't going to pass up Cybok. I think it's a really, really interesting character. I know it's how you never mentioned you had a brother. Oh, funny that. But yeah, I found it really, really interesting, fascinating. And to have, yeah, this emotional Vulcan older brother and this non-emotional human older sister, and then Spock in the middle, like you say, trying to find this third way. And a lot of the book, I think, is about Spock trying to find a third way, you know, again, with sort of trying to find a third way between Vulcan and Romulus. I think, okay, where can we, what path can we take that won't keep these old divisions going, because that leads nowhere. And much of his life, he's sort of pondering that and trying to make it work, and always alert to where people are crossing those boundaries. So I think Gabriel Burnham is an important figure here, and all sorts of different people. So he's always thinking about how to break those kind of divisions and binaries down. I think gets her in the end. Gets there quite early, actually. It's just hard with Sarek around.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I found really interesting with regards to the Cybok story was his mother, Sarek's first wife, and this whole aspect of her kind of going off into the retreat, performing, you know, completing Kolinar, and then this kind of isolation of being basically sealed into this cell in the mountains. That was really, and again, yeah, it's coming up a lot, really fascinating aspect of the story. And I'm wondering, what was kind of, was there kind of an inspiration for that? And where did that idea come from?
Oh, it's sort of these medieval anchorites and anchoresses that would go off and they would sort of, I don't know how much of it is apocryphal, but the idea would be that you would, some medieval churches in certainly in Britain, and I presume in Europe as well, have these little sort of buildings at the side with just this sort of little window in, and that's where the hermit was. And the idea is that they would be sealed away as a kind of to do the praying and the meditating, and be a sort of pure space on behalf of people who are still out in the world. So it's quite a well documented thing, and there were various rituals associated with it, sort of being a, you know, you would be considered dead. They were usually quite wealthy. It was usually a choice that a woman, or it might be a choice that a woman would make rather than marriage, or a kind of conventional choice in a convent or nunnery. You would probably have to be quite wealthy, because someone had to be paying for the upkeep. So it was a solution for your family if they had too many daughters. But it struck me as a sort of fascinating, really interesting thing to do. And I don't know to what extent, you know, our myths about them are true. I've not looked enough into kind of the literature about it. But I thought if anyone was absolutely going to commit to this and do it in the way that we kind of romanticize this or fantasize it, it would be a Vulcan adept. I mean, they would just seal the door and get on with it, you know, be like, oh, complete mind over any sensation. So it's those medieval hermits, sort of anchorites and anchoresses, these sort of religious orders that would seal themselves away. Trappist monks do this as well. They sort of take vows of silence. So I think they have more of a kind of community life. They do sort of pray together and go to mass and church together, but don't speak very much. That just came to mind for this figure. I just wondered what that story was. And this sort of intense outburst of emotion from Cybok, what was the dynamic of that marriage that this boy came out the other end quite obviously quite damaged. So this just seemed right, just seemed to work. So she was an interesting character to write. I think there's some beta canon that says she was a Vulcan princess or priestess or something, so I kind of ran with that as well. Yeah, you never expect it. Those bits are really easy to write. I mean, they were quite bleak. I kind of went, you read this stuff years ago and you never know when it's going to pop out. So all those hours spent reading about medieval anchorites kind of paid off. I think people call that research.
All I do is research Star Trek. I would do a terrible job with a Star Trek novel because I can't bring anything else into it. But yeah, I'm so glad you went to Cybok. I'll be honest with you, Una. If you didn't put anything Cybok in here, I'd say, why? Like, come on, you know, we need to just at least address it. And it made it interesting. I mean, it just informs his life. Everybody who comes into his life has something to do with how he progresses through it, what he learns from them. And even just the teachings of Surak, I think, and we've, you know, read these things before and stuff, but the whole idea, and I like how you said that the logic without emotion was barren and meaningless. This is the things he learned, that there is emotion in Surak's later teachings that are misunderstood.
Yeah, that was really good fun. That if, you know, if Surak had lived another 10 years, I think you see this. This is sort of the narrative that people talk about, the philosophy of Wittgenstein, that he spends the sort of first half of his career writing in this very kind of dry analytic philosophy, and then he does this book called which one is it? It's the Tractatus. I can't remember. It's sort of 30 years since I thought about that. He kind of does this book that kind of says that's all rubbish. Mm. Here's what I think, and then we get some more, and it goes a little bit more kind of not mystical, but a little bit more sort of associative perhaps, rather than analytic. So I imagine Surak sort of treading this sort of very steady line of logical, rigorous philosophy, and then just sort of going, actually that's dead end, we've got to think about it this way. But he doesn't write enough about it that people sort of see it as a kind of, oh, had he gone a bit cranky at the end or something, whereas in fact he's kind of developing a new style of philosophy. He's found meaning elsewhere, so that's sort of what I had in mind. All these things that I don't really know very much about. I kind of skim over and think, I'll nick that for a Star Trek book one day. But it makes me look really brainy.
It does, yeah. Don't give out the secret. Come on.
I could nick that. That'd be great. So that's where that came from. There's a thing as well called late style that I got really interested in, about sort of writers who reach their 80s seem to acquire a new sort of style in their art. You see it in Beethoven, and I think you see it in Le Guin as well. And there's a sort of, I think because historically not many people have lived to their 80s, yeah? It's almost like, we talk about maybe three ages of man or whatever, but this is a sort of extra stage where you suddenly see this burst of productivity, and it's almost like people are going, right, okay, I've not got long, yeah? It's really, really, really important that you listen to what I've picked up over the last 84 years, because really, time's running out and there's a lot up here. And it's like, if you look at like the Gwyn's last 5 years, it's incredible. It's just an amount of stuff that comes out. And you see that a lot. There's a sort of, it's a beautiful style of a kind of depth of experience of time, but at the same time, a kind of sudden understanding of the importance of the moment. And that I think is kind of what I think of as late style. And I imagine Surak getting there. And this book, I think, is meant to be Spock's sort of moment of late style, an awareness of all the time he's lived through and the preciousness of these moments that are present. So that's sort of what I had in mind as well. Okay, it sounds incredibly clever, doesn't it? I've read half of an introduction of a book on this.
No, that's excellent, because, you know, what you're saying about that late style, that's really putting into focus a lot of this book for me. It makes a lot of sense because, you know, as I'm reading it, you know, there's the parts that take place during his time at the Academy, and I'm picturing, you know, Zachary Quinto Spock and the Discovery era. I'm picturing Ethan Peck, but through it all is this Spock just before he goes and attempts the Red Matter mission and all that happens in the J.J. Abrams stuff. This elderly Spock who, you know, he's Leonard Nimoy. He's that familiar Spock voice. But I always felt his portrayal of Spock in Star Trek 2009, yeah, he has a lot more kind of lyrical, yeah, quality to how he, yeah, talks. It feels a little lighter. So that makes a lot of sense to me, that, like, yeah, he's got some humor in here. He's got some, like, knowing winks to Picard, the reader of this. Like, I love the Spock that you've given voice to here. It
Thank
really
you very
fits
much.
For me.
Yeah, and lyrical is that exactly makes sense that. What you're and saying. That sort of, he's very funny by the end. Yeah, he's you know, and he finally relaxes and lets his intelligence, mm-hmm, lets his wit sort of come forward. Yeah. Oh, lovely. I'm really glad. I'm really glad that sort of comes through. Yeah. It'd be nice to think Nimoy's voice sort of comes through the book. It was something we're very conscious of, I think. But yeah, that sort of late in your life, that wisdom and joyfulness, actually, I observe as well. And then he's kind of going around, now I'm going to do this crazy thing because, you know, why not? Why not? Time's short. It's worth it.
Yep. He's always there to save the universe. But now you touch on his time on the Enterprise, both under Pike and Kirk. And I also, of course, you know, number one's name is Una, but you address the new last name. And I'm just curious, did you come up with the name and give the show that, or the opposite?
I didn't come up with that name. No. They said, put this in. They'll love that. So that's
Riley.
A little thing that we put in. For people to enjoy. So it was tricky navigating Treasury Wells because obviously the book was going to come out long before, you know, we're sort of seeing the show, but we did want it to feel like it inhabited that world, and that was, I guess, a way of doing that. And people, we thought people would be excited. So once they gave me that, they said, "Put this in; they'll love it."
See, the thing I love about reading these books is I keep thinking about you as I'm reading them. I know I think about Spock too, of course, but I'm just thinking like, how is Una going to address this? Because once we get to the Pike years, I'm like, Strange New Worlds is coming soon. Yeah. That's going to open up a whole other thing that she won't know anything about, or even if they did tell her, she's not allowed to say anything about it. But it's like, how do you navigate that? And I love the fact that you just focus on the relationship that he has with Pike, and not necessarily going through all the what adventures and what they went and did and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, Talos IV and everything. But what he learns from Pike in number one, you know, and then how meaningful his relationship is with Kirk.
Yeah. And then, and they're sort of a prototype. I sort of imagine them as a sort of first go round of that sort of functional family that he finds on the Enterprise, you know, when we first meet Spock in the 60s. There was nothing we could do about when the book was coming out and, you know, how Strange New Worlds was coming out. But yeah, we could say, well, what was the meaning of this person in the whole of his life? And then things like the short trek were a real gift because you could kind of, you know, there's a teachable moment, I think they called it. You know, what are my impressions of Pike? People would want to know that. They would want to know what he'd learned from Pike or what is at this stage of it in his life. What he thought of this man, and the impact that the man had had on him. So those were stories that we could tell, I think, rather than, as you say, going through sort of adventures that, you know, haven't been screened, or necessarily even scripted. I'm not quite sure, but we tried our best. But they're always going to be. There's plenty of other stuff to put in. We went short of material.
Yeah. I did enjoy how deftly some of that was handled and how that's kind of mirrored with the stories of the 5-year mission as well, where, you know, Spock knows his audience and he says, what hasn't been written about those 5 years? You know, like, what can I possibly add? Like, this moment was meaningful. This moment was meaningful. Moving on, kind of thing. Like, it's like, that makes a lot of sense. Whereas, you know, the Voyager autobiography, I feel like the audience she was writing for would be eager for all of the Delta Quadrant stories. You know, the audience Spock is writing for, they've heard all of these stories. They want inside the head of Spock. They don't, you know, they don't need to be told about how Commodore, you know, so-and-so sacrificed himself to eliminate the Doomsday Machine. We know that story, you know, like,
yes, yeah, exactly that. And it was something we really had to think about. That was something that I know John Van Sitter said again and again, you don't worry about that. You know, it's what these people meant to him and his reflections on them at this point in his life. That's really what this book is called. It is central to this book. His thoughts about these people that he has known in this very long life. Because, yeah, you know, we all know those episodes. Yeah, we all know those stories. So I could sort of take a few risks there. I think maybe it was a little frustrating. I think people hoped for, possibly some readers might have hoped for more, but you know, this is the book that came out. So, you know, just got to run with your instincts, I think.
I have to tell you, before I started reading the book, a friend of the show mentioned to us that he had read the book and there wasn't much Kirk in there. Mm. And he was a little disappointed by that. Mm-hmm. And I went into that knowing it, and I was like, well, you know, that's his feelings, but I know somebody else who this is like in his top 10 of all Star Trek novels, and he's read like 400. So. you know, I didn't miss it. You know, because there's, like you said, there's so much about Spock. I felt like it was so personal about his family and more of his childhood and growing up to become the man that he is. And like we said, there's already enough that the audience and Jean-Luc know about Kirk and Spock. But there was a line earlier in the book, and I don't remember what he was talking about, but it was something to do with the fact that it's sometimes harder to talk about those things that mean the most to you. Mm-hmm. And I almost felt like Spock thinks everything that needs to be said about his relationship with Kirk is known, but also because Kirk means so much to him, he doesn't really want to dwell on it too much because it's a lot for him. You know, there's a lot of feeling and pain there.
Yeah. I mean, for me, and I know people where it's certainly, and I, you know, some people have said, oh, Kirk isn't in it. I feel Kirk's on every page. Yeah. The loss of Kirk is, the great bereavement of his life. It's like it's a sort of widowhood. It's his a widowhood, yes. And it for me, it's there on every page. And the positioning of that chapter, it's like I can't put this off any longer. You know, I've not even been able to go and look at his grave. I've sort of kept him in this Schrodinger state almost of you know, I think of him being alive when I thought he was dead, and now I know he's dead, I can sort of pretend he's still alive. Yeah, but it's a it's a almost a loss that can't be, you know, for a man that's literate and that's intelligent to struggle to find words to talk about this loss. I felt my intention was for the silences to speak volumes. That
that's what it worked yeah. for me yeah. in that way. Yeah,
and the positioning at the end, it's like, you know, everything is sort of. And that where we leave them, which is what I hoped people would leave this book with, that image of the three of them as, you know, young men. I found it really moving to watch them, you know, go back and rewatch the original series and see how young they all were and how fit and how, you know, they're bounding around and you go, oh my God, these sort of, you know, they're so young and active, they're, you know, probably younger than I am now and this sort of thing. And then I just wanted people to have that image of, you know, the turbo lift doors or whatever it is, that, you know, the doors closing on Kirk and Spock and McCoy, and that they're eternal. You know, it's like Robin Hood forever in the greenwood or something, you know. And that's what you want to think of Kirk and Spock and McCoy being. They're always heading down to the bridge for the next, you know, the next adventure. And that's how Spock wants to remember Kirk. So I'm getting a bit stiffly thinking about it. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's the single most important relationship in his life. I think, and it's a huge loss to him that he dies that young, and to McCoy as well. It's like, you know, they've lost their right arm or something, lost their heart. Yeah.
And to echo what Bruce was saying as well, like that. When I was reading it, that's how it felt, was that like Spock was like approaching this, you know, point where he's going to talk about it. And then he's like, it's like touching a hot stove and he kind of pulls back and says, okay, well, let's focus on something else right now. You know, he would never quite bring himself to really get deep into that subject until we get to that chapter where that's the closest he kind of comes. But it still feels like you said, it's just this. Like, I think of when Sarek says, my logic is uncertain where my son is concerned. Like, this is where all of Spock's control and poise kind of starts to unravel a little bit. And he's like, I can't really deal with this. And, you know, I don't know, still come across as coherent on this, because it's just, it's too close, you know.
And I think it's a very, you know, ultimately, even though this is a memoir, and one that he's giving to Picard for publication, this is a private love and a private grief. And I think part of him is thinking, I don't actually owe anyone this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. if this is what remains, you know, I'll say what I want and need to say, and people, you know, I can arrange this material, you know, bring it all, you know, bring it all together on the image of Kirk, and people can sort of extrapolate from that. But that was sort of the intent. It was an interesting chapter to write. I wrote it very quickly, but I did write it. I just put the words down, and I did write it last because it's so important. There's an excellent essay that I mentioned in the back by Erin Horakova called Kirk Drift. And it's completely brilliant. It's published online in Strange Horizons. They have a regular column called Freshly Remembered, and they go back to pop culture icons and go, well, actually, have you watched the episodes recently? Because everything you know about it is wrong. Mm-hmm. And yes. She does this incredible job with Kirk. It's like, poof, wow, yeah, of course. No, it's nothing like this. It's nothing like the guy in the 2009 movie. That's what popular memory has made it. But the Kirk you see on screen in the 60s. So I love him. It's kind of what seemed completely consistent to me was having Kirk and Spock's grandfather going hammer and tongs about Spinoza, you know. It was just, yeah, I'm here for this, you know.
And that was great, yeah.
Yeah, Spock's like, I'm leaving this to the experts, you know. That seems a kind of Kirk that we don't see so often. And that would be the kind of Kirk that Spock would have known. Mm-hmm. And loved. Yeah.
Yeah, the Kirk who beat him regularly at chess in the early days and was a walking stack of books with legs and officer and gentleman, right? Like that was Kirk. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Survivor of a massacre, mm-hmm. as well. All these things that we forget about Kirk, I think. And that would be the man that he served with. So yeah. So I wanted to do something maybe a little different. But I hope that his absence doesn't mean that I hope it's clear to people that it's an absence of derived from deep feeling. Yeah. You know, it's one of those, the less you say, the more it means.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. That's how it felt to me.
Good. Yeah, I'm glad. Absolutely. Good. Thank you. Good. Yeah. Phew.
Because if it did, I would call you on that too, not just
you would.
You know, Cybok,
I'd have some kind of sneaky answer.
Yeah,
I'd come one up on the spot. Oh well, this is all intentional. Yes,
that's why we call you Doctor. So, I want to talk about Savick and Valeris. We've gotten some backstories of them just from behind the scenes materials and things that have worked in novels and comics. So I was wondering, where did you pull for some of their backstories, and how much of that was your own creation?
Yeah, I drew on some Valeris stuff, the Helgard stuff. I can't remember where that is now. Is that in a Jean Laura novel or I can't remember now. I should be able to remember these things, but I'm old
remembering
and tired.
It from the Pandora Principle. Yes. Carolyn Close, but I can't remember if she got that from another place before that.
Yeah, or if it's hinted at in one of the scripts or something like that. So I thought this is a really interesting figure. I know there wasn't there an intention for her in one of the films to be pregnant with Spock's child? I thought, oh God, that's completely misread this relationship. That's not it at all. It's closer to father-daughter.
I agree with that too, because we've had a book called Vulcan's Heart years ago that had them get married, because there's a line in TNG with Sarek that says Picard was at his son's wedding.
And I decided that was Cybok's wedding.
who did Cybok marry?
I don't know. This isn't Cybok's autobiography, is it? So, okay. I decided that wasn't relevant. So I looked at that line. I thought, yeah, it's not Spock, is it? That's ridiculous. So I decided not to. I decided I didn't have to worry about that. So I guess Sarvik, then, I wanted to think of her as a again, she's another figure that's caught between a dual heritage. So I wanted her narrative to be a kind of resolution of that. So there were two steps that I was kind of pleased with. This sort of Amanda wanted to rush in and kind of adopt her. And Spock going, no, you can't fix the mistakes of Michael with this child. This is a different child. Because that would be quite tempting to do. And then I'm really pleased that I sent her off to join the co-op Milat. I think that was a really, I was really pleased with that resolution.
I was going to mention, I love that. Yeah. I love picturing. I can see her doing that.
Yeah, it would allow her to be Romulan and not Romulan, in the way that Spock has been seeking to be Vulcan and not Vulcan. You know, you can't deny that this is Romulan, but not as you know it. Yeah. kind of thing. So that was sort of my thinking with Sarvik, and that she would be rock solid. She would be a kind of, you know, his almost his first student, his first mentee. It's completely, it's really rock solid. And then Valeris perhaps would be the flip side of that. Maybe Spock has become a little bit complacent about what he can teach. And I found that scene in six where he, you know, he mind melds. I found it incredibly uncomfortable. You know, it really crosses a line to do with consent, you know, use of torture, these sorts of things. It's quite a complex and very actually a deeply on Spock like thing to do. I thought that he really needed to reflect upon. That he would regret it. He would think that was not a thing I should have done. It was non-consensual. It was, you know, it amounted to to torture. And he would reflect on that and regret it. But I liked the idea that Valeris was unrepentant. You know, that she felt she was justified, and never really repented of it. I think it'd be very easy to have every relationship in his life be completely successful, and everyone sort of to be persuaded of his wisdom. Yeah. Somebody has to not be. mm-hmm. Yeah. And why should she be persuaded of his wisdom? He forcibly mind melded with her. Yeah? Why should she respect him?
I think one of the most chilling moments reading this book was the moment where Spock is talking to Valeris after all of this, and Valeris has this almost kind of pride in Spock that he went that far and did that to her. And I was just like, oh, the fact that someone whose logic led them to the conclusions and the actions that Valeris did would not approve of, but, you know, see the wisdom in what Spock did to her was chilling. I was, oh, yeah. This is a, yeah. Terrible even, person.
Even you, I've persuaded of, you know, even you will do things out of necessity that are against you claim are against your values. So you prove my point. Yeah, she's quite unrepentant, I think. I'm surprised Section 31 don't recruit her.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. I want to touch a little on the 24th century, a little more on that with Pardak and Spock's reunification efforts and how he didn't really accomplish fully what he was trying to do and his whole relationship with the Romulans and then his later relationship with his father, with Sarek. Yeah, talk a little bit about that. It really made me appreciate the older Spock and what he was dealing with at that time, because what was going on in the galaxy.
I tell you what, I got really into that stuff. I would have happily given you a novel of Spock's ministry on Romulus. I would have just sat and did that one. I think I've now sketched what I would have done in it. So I think you've got to, but I could have, I could have done 90,000 words on that quite happily. I thought it was profoundly interesting that, you know, he just packs up and goes on this fool's quest. and then, you know, galactic events just completely pull the rug out from under him, you know, the star goes supernova. So I thought that was a really, I just got incredibly interested in that. And particularly thinking about it in terms of the sort of way that the Romulan society has been set up in Star Trek Picard, this sort of emphasis on secrecy secrets just underpin every aspect of life, the way they build their houses or, you know, the theatre or their music, everything. And to plonk him in the middle of that and, you know, see how he would cope with that, I just thought it'd be really interesting. Really enjoyed writing those bits. So,
I had a funny feeling you were, because I remember reading it thinking, I feel like Una's enjoying this like she does when she writes about Cardassians and the Union and everything.
Yeah, there was, it was a different, I just loved the idea of him just sort of turning up with a suitcase, kind of setting up in some house and just sort of sitting on and going, hello, yep, Spock, yep, live long and prosper.
Sitting in the park.
Yeah, exactly. How are you today? And then, and that's basically his plan. That's his plan, and it kind of ripples. And I thought it'd be an incredibly interesting thing to it. So I might do that with a different book. And it goes back to the sort of monasticism that you see in, you know, his Cybok's mother, or you know, his own experience of trying to achieve Kolinar. That those you know, hours spent meditating and trying to efface his self and his emotion. He would have this sort of internal reserves of sort of strength and just ability to be patient and be very focused on a particular person at any moment. And I loved that. You know, it wasn't going to be kind of high level diplomacy. He tried that with Pardek, yeah, and people just did the deal. They're Romulan diplomats. So they're going to do. They're telling you one thing. They're telling, you know, they're telling themselves one thing, and their other hand the other thing. You know, they're lying to themselves. So that's no use. He's tried that, so he needs to try something incredibly radical, and that's just to sort of go out and sit on the street and talk to people. And then the Tashia there in 15 minutes is like, bloody hell, no, we can't have this. It's a terrible idea. Yeah. This is awful. And his defense is basically that the Coet Malats are entertained and go, yeah, you'll kind of do what we're doing, but, you know, we've got weapons. And the fact that he is Spock, that, you know, they can't disappear him. They can't risk it. They don't know what his sort of communication lines back to Starfleet Command are. So they can't really risk it. He's too important. So he's sort of protected by that, and then more practically by the Coet Malats, kind of amused. But that's his plan, basically. Yeah, just gonna talk to people.
I found it really telling that the Coet Milat showed up, because, of course, their whole obsession with lost causes. I was like, yeah. Oh, there's a little bit of subtext here, I think.
No, just, crikey, mate, there's absolute candor and there's complete insanity, you know.
In a society where showing kindness is a subversive act, right? Like,
it's incredible to
read that this outlandish thing that he's doing, which is to talk to people about what they're having for dinner that night, you know, like that's sedition, you know.
Yeah, there's no secrecy and there's no guile in what he's offering, because they don't have anything that he wants other than knowledge of themselves. He just wants to learn who these people are and learn about them and have a meeting of minds with them. That's all he wants, really. There's no ulterior motive than peace. I watched the end of that Next Gen episode. There he is on kind of the streets of the Romulan capital. I'm thinking, what exactly is the plan now, Spock? you're there with, you know, your toothbrush and your change of robes. What happens now? You know, have you got a hotel? These are always the things that go, you kind of watch that in the grand moment. You think, I know, but whose house are you going to stay at? You know, who's paying for this? Are you going to get a regular column in the paper? You know, how are you? And all these things that run through my mind, and this is kind of what I ended up with. So, but really, I would have happily written a book about this. Although it was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see that word's coming up. Yeah, put that on the list. This is a future book that you can do. I love the idea.
You're here.
So.
Yeah,
but
you might see that story in another form somewhere one day, perhaps. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a very sort of Le Guin story, I think. Actually, the more I think, it's the kind of thing maybe Ursula Le Guin would put in her books. That's probably where I bought it from. That kind of quiet revolutionary. A lot of her ecumen guys in things like Left Hand of Darkness sort of rock up quite cluelessly, and events happen.
Well, especially with the payoff that we get, really 900 years down the line, where this all did spark what is eventually the reunification. Like honestly, watching The Next Generation at the time when I watched it as a kid, I'm like, oh, that's a neat idea. Spock's trying to get the Romulans and Vulcans. Well, it'll never happen. Like, they'll never write that. But, oh, wow, what an interesting. And then now, you know, however many decades later, we get in Star Trek Discovery, they are reunified. And I see those episodes in a totally different light now. And that would be a really cool story to tell from the beginning.
And he gets a little premonition of that, doesn't he? He gets that kind of aftershock.
Right.
Of the, he sort of sees this, he has this sort of dream of a vision of Gabrielle, doesn't he? Sort of human woman on Vulcan in a Romulan gown. And it's everything. He'd sort of, you know, that kind of unification of three things there. So he gets a little glimpse, and he does think in long time, in deep time. You know, his sister's a millennium away. so he will think that way. Yeah.
So to end this book, because this is a wisdom book written to Jean-Luc Picard, what did Picard learn from reading this from Spock?
Oh, good question. I think Spock is sort of encouraging, because Picard at this point is kind of, between his resignation and, you know, the start of the first season of the show, Star Trek Picard. So he's sort of sulking in his castle, isn't he? So I hope that Spock is, I think Spock says to him, you know, my kind of goals were, you know, my great project came to this sort of ignominious end, but it's not the end. You won't know that for a long time. So don't give up. Yeah. Because you, I guarantee you that you will decide to act again. And he's right. So, and whether Picard is able to hear that at the time or only realize later that maybe that was a pebble that sort of set that avalanche going, that would be sort of what I think Picard would learn. That was a good question. I hadn't thought about that before.
Oh, wow. I asked actually a good question for once, Dan.
Sorry, I went to just say that your questions are always brilliant. They're always really fantastic. But I was a bit sort of your supervisor there. That was very good question. Candidate to be.
There you go. Well, you made my day. There you go. So, well, is there anything else you want to say about the book before we wrap up? Because, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I feel like I knew so much about Spock, but I still learned something new about him.
Well, I'm just really relieved about that, because, you know, I the fear was that it was kind of, you know, people would think, oh, it's just familiar ground. So to sort of try and do, we want to do something fresh. So I'm glad it was. And the only thing I'd say is try the beans.
I actually want to try that recipe. Yeah,
you really must. My friend who came up with the recipe is a fantastic chef. He's had a Michelin star. It's a gorgeous recipe. It's really, really delicious. So cook the beans and make yourself a mint julep and toast the Enterprise, definitely. But it will be delicious. It will be. Yeah, you'll enjoy it. So eat the beans. Hashtag Spock's beans.
Now, the mint julep is from the Star Trek cocktails book.
Yeah. What? We said, let's put these in. And then I think Dayton said, oh, you know, there was a cocktails book. If we ask them nicely, they'll let us reprint it. So and unfortunately, they were up for it. So we just thought it'd be a bit of fun at the end. It's like what McCoy leaves him in his will. Eat great. Some food and have a drink, which is very McCoy, isn't it? It's kind of like, you know, focus on the fellowship and those moments of, you know. So, so eat some beans and have a drink.
That's the lesson for today.
That's the lesson.
Have some beans.
Have a drink.
Have a drink. Yes, let's do that. Well, I know that you're busy, so we don't want to keep you any longer because you've still got a lot of writing to do. I know you're working on some projects. So tell us what's coming down the pike. Well, no pun intended, the pike thing. And where can people find you online?
Oh, well, find me at Una McCormack on Twitter, where I'm being cross about things and watching. I'm reading The Expanse now. I'm not tweeting too much about The Expanse because I feel it's really important that people don't get spoiled. But I am tweeting sort of OMGs a lot. And then coming down the pipeline, we have I've got a Firefly novel coming out in November, which that's great. That's like a tick on my wish list. So that's imminent. Publication problems in distribution in the publishing industry allowing, but also I'm working on another Picard novel about Raffi, so that people should see next year, and that I think is everything I can talk about.
There's those cryptic answers again. You're wondering.
Love it. I always love those cryptic answers because we know that whatever is coming is going to be amazing and wonderful. It's when the authors say, oh, there's nothing going on, not doing anything. That's when I get sad. Yeah. So we know there's something.
Yeah. Well, I'd never say that. I'd just go, ah, who knows? Yeah. So No, don't tell them that there's nothing. Make people think you're busy.
Love it.
All right. Well, Dan, where can people find you online if they want to talk Star Trek?
You can find me always on Twitter. I'm at Kertrats. That's Kertrats. On youtube.com/Kertrats Productions and in the Positively Trek discussion group, which, comment on the thread for this novel. We're going to be having a great discussion there, I'm sure. So join us, please.
Ooh, yes. And I'm on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex. That's Admiral with the underline Rex. Yeah, find us on Twitter, Instagram, whatever, Positively Trek. Send us an email, positivelytrek@gmail.com. And we have a Goodreads group, too. So we can discuss novels there if we want to do it there, if not in the Facebook group. But, you know, wherever, you know where you can find us. So the autobiography of Mr. Spock, written by Spock, edited by Una McCormack. Buy it today if you haven't already. Yes, check it out. And Una, thank you so much again for joining
us. My absolute pleasure. It's always great to talk to you guys. They're always really, really good questions. I always really enjoyed talking to you. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it's always great to have you on the show. It's always a fun discussion.
Thank you.
Yes. So keep writing, and to everyone in you, Una, stay positive.
Indeed.